Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. This week, we spend the hour with Amy Goodman, host and executive producer of Democracy Now! And My Sister. Amy is spending today and tomorrow on tour as part of a national book tour for the release of our new book, which is called Democracy Now! 20 Years Changing, Covering the Movements Changing America. And she'll be in Montpelier tonight at the Vermont College of Fine Arts at 7 p.m. That's Wednesday. And on Thursday at Bennington College at noon and at the Unitarian Church in Burlington on Thursday evening at 7 p.m. So, Amy, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
It's great to be with you, bro.
Okay. Well, take us back 20 years. What was the need for Democracy Now! At that time? What was not happening in the media?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. Here we broadcast on WDEV every weekday at 5:30. And 21 years ago, we were only going to be on for like 8 months. It was the re-election of Bill Clinton that year, it turned out. But we were just going to cover the primaries. We were the only daily election show in public broadcasting. So it was a short-term project. But there was more demand for the show after the election than before. And I think that's because of the hunger for independent voices. I mean, we didn't cover the election in your typical way with pundits and polls. We talked to people on the ground in the states using the primaries as our roadmap. But I was really interested why the majority of people didn't vote. I didn't think it was apathy, but how were they involved in their communities? What were they doing? And what were the impediments to voting? How is it that we're alone in the industrialized world and the low level of voting? I mean, you have a tremendous problem now with voter suppression. But it was also beyond that. Yes, our country doesn't make it easy for people to vote. In other countries, they facilitate it every which way, whether it's weekend voting or you have the day off from work. Here, you know, the poll times are limited and there are fewer and fewer polls, and especially in communities of color around the country. But, you know, this is going back over two decades. And we just felt it was critical to see how people were engaged on the ground. And I think that was the excitement for everyone beyond the election. It's the authenticity of grassroots voices, not your typical pundits you get on the networks who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong.
You have referred to Democracy Now! As the underground railroad of information. What do you mean by that?
I mean, we're talking about information that somehow seems almost illicit, or I would like an explanation why the media doesn't cover it. I'll give you an example. I mean, this year, Labor Day weekend, we went to North Dakota to cover the largest unification of Native American tribes in decades. It began April 1st with LaDonna Brave Bull Aller, the unofficial historian of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. And they were deeply concerned, the Standing Rock Sioux, about the Dakota Access Pipeline, this $3.8 billion pipeline that would go through North Dakota, South Dakota, taking the fracked oil from the Bakken oil fields through Iowa into Illinois and a pipeline down to the Gulf. And first, hundreds of people came to the resistance camp she'd opened up on her property on the Cannonball River. And then there were so many people, they opened 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 resistance camps, and they were protesting this continuation of our dependence on the fossil fuel economy. And they were particularly concerned that the pipeline goes under the longest river in North America, the Missouri River, and that would pollute the water of some 17 million people, not just Native Americans, downstream. And they see themselves as water protectors, not protesters. So how does this tie in to your question? This was in the midst of the election year. And you have, I hesitate to say journalists on television, news personalities. Did they ask one question about climate change in the general election debates? One question about an issue that will determine the fate of the planet? And in the midst of this historic gathering of people, hundreds of people were getting arrested in civil disobedience. And so we went out there and we covered the resistance, the ceremonies, and then as we were there covering the protests around the Dakota Access Pipeline, the pipeline guards unleashed dogs on the Native Americans, biting them. And we posted that video online. And within 24, 48 hours, there were 14 million views. That shows people care in this country and around the world. People care about climate change. People care about people being bitten by dogs. As Winona LaDuke said, the Native American leader from the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota, you know, she said to the governor, "You are not George Wallace. This is not 1965 Alabama. We are through." But this electrified people around the country, enraged people. Ultimately, the Obama administration would say the pipeline had to stop while they did an investigation. And then when President Trump came into office, one of his first acts was to give the go-ahead, not only for DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, but also for the Keystone XL, which had long been killed by protesters like Middlebury professor Bill McKibben, who founded 350.org, Naomi Klein, the great writer who wrote This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. They had gotten arrested outside the White House, Keystone XL. This was the 2011, 6 years ago, and ultimately it was killed. I don't say President Obama and then the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton would have said no to the pipeline on their own, but with the mass protests they did. And we give voices to people. We give voice to people at the grassroots, and that is what the media should be doing, going to where the silence is, which is often not that silent when you actually turn on your microphone there.
Well, speaking of your trip to North Dakota, you have in our new book a whole section called An Independent Reporter's Rap Sheet. And it details the times you've been, not just arrested, but in the case of East Timor, beaten, when your colleague Alan Nairn had his skull fractured by Indonesian soldiers, your arrest at the 2008 Republican National Convention, where you were thrown to the ground in your efforts to release Democracy Now! Producers who were just there covering protests in the street. So what happened in North Dakota? You ended up being arrested and charged.
That's right. I mean, it was very serious after that Labor Day weekend where we went to North Dakota and showed the video of the pipeline guards' dogs biting Native Americans and their horses. We came back to New York. It was that week after Labor Day. And on Thursday night, the North Dakota Republican governor called out the National Guard because a controversial decision was going to be handed down by the judge the next day. And it was pretty well assumed he was going to rule against the tribe. And unbeknownst to me, the authorities also issued an arrest warrant for me. I mean, I was back broadcasting Democracy Now! In New York. You know, we broadcast on 1,400 public television and radio stations and WDEV right here in Vermont. And actually, on Friday of that week, I had gone up to Toronto to the International Film Festival, where there was a film that premiered on the great muckraking journalist I.F. Stone. He told students, if you're going to remember two words, remember government's lie. If you're going to remember three, all governments lie. And that's the name of the film, All Governments Lie. And it talked about the independent media today. And it focused on Democracy Now! As well as Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone. So I went up to Toronto with Matt, as well as Nermeen Sheikh, co-host on Democracy Now!. And we're speaking after the film and the next day. And I thought it was important to get to talk about the Dakota Access Pipeline in Canada, where there's a deep concern for what they call First Nations. And next day, I was speaking at University of Toronto. And in the middle of my talk, I get this text on my phone, "You're under arrest." I didn't even know where the number was from. So, of course, I thought it was a hoax. But it turned out it was from a North Dakota lawyer and said an arrest warrant has been issued for you. So I had a problem. I was in Canada. Now, when you have an arrest warrant for you, it won't necessarily be picked up right away. But if you have an interaction with police or the FBI or border guards, you know, I was over the border, then if it's in the system, you will be picked up. and I had to get over the border before this went into the system. I mean, I just learned this in the middle of the talk. I said, could someone get me a cab to the airport, please? I couldn't say what it was because I wanted to get over the border before this information got out. And I was able to get over the border, but and I didn't take this arrest warrant personally. I mean, I think it was a warning to journalists that the state of North Dakota issued. Do not come to North Dakota, which is exactly why we need to be there. And so a few weeks later, we went back to challenge my charges and to let especially young independent journalists know, yes, you can go to North Dakota and not be worried that the authorities are going to sweep you up.
Well, and in fact, many journalists, and especially the freelancers and independent journalists, have been arrested there, and it's extremely intimidating.
Absolutely. They don't want those images out there of dogs, of riot police, of a fully militarized sheriff's department. It's, I mean, you know, like Ferguson, that image of the tear gas and the robocops. So we went back, and as we flew into Bismarck, North Dakota, of course, you know, calling their bluff, they lifted the charges. They dropped them. They said there wasn't grounds for the charges, of course. And we went and we covered the protests over the weekend. But while they lifted, the prosecutor lifted those charges, he then imposed another. He was going to have me arraigned the following Monday on riot charges, for which I would face a year in jail. This is pure harassment and intimidation. And so on that Monday, we broadcast from in front of the courthouse and the jail. They're right next to each other in Mandan, North Dakota. In between them is the Ten Commandments. And, you know, I was going to have to turn myself in, be arraigned or go to jail, so I'd be right there. And we interviewed there in front of the courthouse the chair of the Standing Rock Sioux, Dave Archambault. He had been arrested months before. He'd never been arrested before, but engaged in civil disobedience, low-level misdemeanor charges. But they put him in they strip-searched him, put him in an orange jumpsuit. I interviewed Dr. Sarah Jumping Eagle, the pediatrician of the reservation. Of course, she protested the Dakota Access Pipeline, concerned about the health of the children on the res, on the reservation. They strip-searched her. They put her in an orange jumpsuit in jail. I mean, the humiliation doesn't stop. And we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of Native Americans. So at the end of our broadcast, we were about to be arraigned. I was about to be arraigned. But ultimately, because there was so much international attention, all the national, the global media was calling in to the judge, you know, is this happening? Am I being charged with riot? They decided not to bring that charge against me. The judge wouldn't sign off on the charges so that I leading to that I wouldn't even be arraigned. But also that day, Native Americans who were charged with felonies and misdemeanors, their charges were dropped. And it just shows what happens when the spotlight is directed in the right place. I am all for reality television, not the kind we get, but the reality on the ground, what people face in this country and around the world. And that's what Democracy Now! Is about.
Why do you think authorities have been so intent on arresting and suppressing your messages over the years, and having a firsthand experience of getting the calls to your family, you're in jail here, you're arrested there. These are memories I are well imprinted in my brain, whether it's from Indonesia or a border station going into Canada.
I think our job is to go to where the silence is. And again, as I said, it's often very noisy, but it doesn't hit the corporate media radar screen. So at the 2008 conventions, we covered the Democratic Convention in Denver. Thousands of people protested there against war. That was the first nomination of Barack Obama. And then we flew to St. Paul, where the Republican convention was, and that was the convention of John McCain and Sarah Palin. And there was mass protest there, peaceful protest, and 10,000 people marched on the beautiful blue sky day of Labor Day, that 2008. And we covered those protests. I went to the convention floor and interviewed, you know, delegates from the hottest state at the time, Alaska. And I got this call. Come quickly to 7th and Jackson, this place in St. Paul. Nicole and Sharif have been beaten and arrested. Nicole Salazar, a multimedia producer, and Sharif Odokadus, our senior producer. I said, what are you talking about? We just were covering the protest. They went into the TV station to digitize tape. And Mike Burke, our senior producer, said, come quickly. This is what's happened. So we raced off the convention floor. I was with Rick Rowley of Big Noise Films, who would later be nominated for an Oscar for Dirty Wars, the film he did with Jeremy Scahill. And we were filming on the floor of the convention, raced to this corner that was an old parking lot. We saw the riot police that surrounded it, but it fully contained the area. So I went up to the riot police to say, I need my colleagues released. You know, I'm responsible for them. And I'd like to speak to your commanding officer. I mean, it wasn't a minute before they ripped me through this police line, pushed me against a car, handcuffed me behind my back, threw me to the ground. And I see Sharif across the parking lot. His arm is bleeding. Ultimately, I'm put in a police van to be taken to the garage, the police garage, where they've erected cages to put the protesters in. Nicole and Sharif are taken to jail in the van. Nicole quickly told me they had been at the TV station. They saw a protest. They went downstairs to film this protest. They wouldn't have been doing their jobs if they hadn't covered it. And then the riot police came right at them and told her to get down on her face. And as she lay on the ground on her face shouting, press, press, they put their knee or boot in her back and they started pulling her leg, which is dragging her face to the gravel. Her face is bleeding. This is just crazy. And Sharif told him to calm down. They threw him up against a wall, punched him twice in the chest, bloodied his arm. So they were taken to jail. I was taken to police garage. I was charged with a misdemeanor. And because of tremendous response to journalists being arrested, they released me, then Nicole and Sharif. And then I was taken to the convention floor. And I was in the NBC skybox. I was being interviewed by journalists. And when the camera was turned off, the NBC reporter came over and said, why wasn't I arrested? And so this is your question, David. Why did I get arrested, right? And I said to the NBC journalist, oh, were you outside covering the protests? And he said, no. I said, well, I don't get arrested in the skybox either. You know, it's our job to be on the convention floor, to get into the corporate suites, to see who's sponsoring the corporation, the conventions, both Democrat and Republican, and to be out on the streets where the uninvited guests are. They have something important to say as well. You know, democracy is a messy thing, and it's our job to capture it all, and we shouldn't have to get a record when we put things on the record. Ultimately, we sued the St. Paul police and the Secret Service, all those who had arrested us, and we won a six-figure settlement. It's unacceptable.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation, and we're spending the hour this week with Amy Goodman, host and executive producer of Democracy Now!, who's in Vermont speaking tonight in Montpelier at the Vermont College of Fine Arts, and tomorrow Thursday in Bennington at noon at Bennington College, and Thursday evening at the Unitarian Church in Burlington. So Donald Trump has referred to journalists as enemies of the people. What is going on here?
I mean, it truly has astounded me. He calls the media the enemy of the people, the enemy of the American people. Why is he doing this? I mean, I sort of hesitate to say this publicly because if he would just stop, you know, I mean, he's punching them every 10 minutes or every hour. It seems almost every day, directly calling out names, talking about them physically, how ugly they are, not to mention talking about fake news. I mean, fake news, it takes one to know one. Who is the man who perpetrated this false story about the president of the United States, the first African-American president, not being born in this country? Yes, the birther movement. Who was the person who perpetrated this and pushed this the farthest? Year after year, it was Donald Trump, even before he ran for president. Who was he trying to delegitimize? President Barack Obama. And he wouldn't stop, not only saying he wasn't born in this country, but saying he was Muslim. And now, mind you, there is nothing wrong with being Muslim, but it just didn't happen to be true about Barack Obama. Yes, this man knows what fake news is all about, and he knows its power. And he is trying to delegitimize the press because of their critical stories about him and deconstructing the lies. And it is actually important that the media is talking about the president of the United States lying. They have rarely said that before. But it's no holds barred now because he has unleashed such a frontal assault on the press. I mean, the media is essential to the functioning of a democratic society. And my colleagues in the corporate press, I'm really glad to see them standing up and showing a backbone around the importance of media. I mean, they speak like independent media journalists now, right? There's a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we're supposed to be the check and balance on power. It is so critical. Thomas Jefferson said, if I had to choose between a government with no newspapers and newspapers without a government, I'd choose the latter. It's really important. You know, what's going on in Washington, D.C., I wanted to ask Noam Chomsky about this. I interviewed him on Monday night at the First Parish Church in Cambridge, and I didn't get to ask him, you know, he's a great world-renowned linguist, about the origins of the term kleptocracy. But that's what we're talking about right now. Not only not learning about what his financial interests are and him surrounding himself by his family, who are also his business partners, but not releasing his tax returns. But it is not only about businesses and how they intertwine with his foreign policy and his domestic policy and how he might be benefiting himself and his family. It's about stealing the truth, and that's what we have to talk about.
Okay, we're going to take a break for the news. We'll be back with more of Amy Goodman here on the Vermont Conversation. I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. We're spending the hour today with Amy Goodman, host and executive producer of Democracy Now! And My Sister. Amy is on a national book tour for a book we've just written called Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America. And she's going to be speaking, we're both going to be speaking tonight in Montpelier at the Vermont College of Fine Arts at 7 o'clock. Tomorrow, Thursday, Bennington College at noon, and at 7 o'clock at night at the Unitarian Church in downtown Burlington. So, Amy, this idea of, you know, President Trump calling the journalists enemies of the people, it is a phrase that actually comes out of authoritarian regimes. I think Joseph Stalin used it. Do you think we are sliding into an authoritarian state?
I mean, you know, we interviewed on Democracy Now! The really father of fascism studies at Columbia University, Professor Emeritus. And he said he was very loath to, you know, use that term, to say the least, lightly. But he said as he watched what was unfolding and, you know, everything from the lies to the obfuscation to the attacks on the press and immigrants looking for scapegoats, he ultimately could not come to any other conclusion. And this was a conservative professor. But I don't think you ever achieve democracy. I think you have to fight for it every day. And this is just an extremely real, in-your-face reminder. I mean, look at what President Trump did once he came into office. You know, the massive protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline before the Keystone XL, he immediately said approves a permit, approves the Dakota Access Pipeline and the calling for the reviving of the Keystone XL. The Muslim ban, 1 and 2. Here you have the CEO of a real estate empire and the president of the United States. And he calls for a stopping of refugees from 7 majority Muslim nations, including Syria, where people are suffering so much. You know, most recently, the bombing of the airfield that the Trump administration did, hitting him with 59 Tomahawk missiles. They used the airfield just the next day. And of course, we think he profited personally from this because they're made by Raytheon And we can't – he doesn't release his tax returns. We don't even know if he is profiting, what the reasons are for his foreign policy motives. You know, yet – I mean, this has never happened in decades. It is not – we have no means to evaluate independently his foreign policy because he won't do this. But hiding this kind of information – the dropping of the bombs in Syria and the Moab in Afghanistan, that's the mother of all bombs, so-called by the Pentagon, nicknamed for massive massive ordnance air blast, which has a blast radius of 1 mile. It was developed under Bush. Even President Bush didn't use it. President Obama didn't use it. And within weeks of his presidency, he's dropping this bomb on Afghanistan. I think it's considered the largest non-nuclear bomb in history that has been dropped. This is frightening because when a president, as President Trump is, at such a low popularity rating, I believe he's at the lowest point in this 100 days of his administration of any president in history, they're going to look for a scapegoat. They look outside at countries, and that's where we see the dropping of bombs and the threatening of North Korea and Iran. I mean, I'm not saying that these countries haven't been declared enemy of the United States by previous presidents, but to escalate to the point where when you're saying you're going to cut the State Department by 30% and international aid organizations, and you're going to increase the military budget by $54 billion, you know, you are decreasing the number of tools in your toolkit. When you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If you only have a military response, this is going to destabilize the world. And then internally in this country, when you're at a very low popularity rating, you look for enemies. And so President Trump targets the press. He goes after Muslims. Muslim ban one. A judge stops it, puts a stay on it, and he calls him a so-called judge. I mean, this CEO is not used to someone saying no, and he thinks he's the CEO of this country. We are engaged in a nationwide civics lesson from little kids to the president of the United States himself. Yes, there are three co-equal branches of government, legislative, executive, judiciary. And yes, a judge can say no. And it's not only President Trump. His attorney general, Jeff Sessions, just recently said at a right-wing on a right-wing radio talk show. You know, this is about Muslim ban two that was stopped by a judge in Hawaii. How is it that a man on an island in the Pacific can stop what the president of the United States wants to do? It's called democracy. Yes, how is it that a judge can stay an order by the president? That's the way our system works. These are the checks and balances of our government. And how is it that the attorney general is asking this question? All of this kind of upping of the ante, threatening immigrants. You know this in Vermont. I mean, on Democracy Now!, we interviewed two immigrants who are immigrants' rights organizers who were picked up. I mean, you have Burlington, a sanctuary city, but still ICE operates. And the Trump administration is enraged that there is this growing sanctuary movement all over the country. You know, I went to a meeting in New York City a few weeks ago, and folks who tuned into Democracy Now! The next day heard some of our guests on the show. This was a room that was just teeming with hundreds of people. It wasn't your everyday activists. And activists are so noble as they dedicate their life to trying to make the world a better place. These were city council members, state legislators, mayors, public officials from all over the country that gathered in New York to say, we are part of the resistance. We are not going to let the president of the United States deconstruct a foundation of civil rights and liberties that our country is based on. It was just amazing to see. And we're seeing this resistance at every single level. So as people get deeply concerned, I think it's also really important to note all of the support and the solidarity that people across the political spectrum, including some Trump supporters, are feeling right now. You know, we're on this multi-city Democracy Now! Covering the Movement's Changing America tour. And I'm really looking forward to being in Montpelier tonight and tomorrow in Bennington, tomorrow night in Burlington. And then we're going to move on to Washington, D.C., where we're going to cover for 5 hours the People's Climate March on Saturday from 10 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon at democracynow.org. And last week we started in Denver. And before we left Denver to go up to British Columbia, I went into the Unitarian Church where Jeanette Vizguerra has taken refuge. She's an immigrant rights activist. She's been in this country for 20 years. She said, I paid taxes for 20 years. She said, I think I did more than President Trump did. It's not clear he hasn't released his tax return, she said. And she has 4 children. Her oldest daughter is DACA, a dreamer, you know, legally here. But she saw that dreamers were being arrested. And she got scared. She's in the process of, you know, the immigration process for years now. What if she was just picked up off the street? She has little children. Her little Zuri, who is 6, and Roberto, who's 10. I got to meet them. They were sleeping in the church. And they were preparing for a march. She's taken refuge, sanctuary, in the church. And they were preparing for a march, a Cesar Chavez march that day. And Roberto was talking to me. Show me this beautiful kind of lithograph that his teacher made, and they're reproducing it and selling it. And it's a image of his mother, very Mayan features. She's a Mexican immigrant. And it says, keep families united. They're so afraid that she could be deported. And I visited her in the church and talked about her stay there for the last 2 months. And she said, for everyone who sends her a death threat, there are hundreds who let her know they are in solidarity. The police chief of Denver came to her. She can't leave the church, and said, I'm with you. And you must tell me if people send you death threats. The mayor of Denver said, I support you. The congressman, Jared Polis, says, I support you. It is an astounding story. So we're seeing these countervailing forces. And just last week, you know, Time magazine came out with its 100 most influential people. You know who one of them was? Jeanette Vizguerra, inside the Unitarian Church in Denver. She barely came outside the press conference. She has to stay inside. You know, her kids get upset if she dares to even begin to take out the garbage. No, we will do this. And what Roberto said to me, the 10-year-old boy, very slight boy, speaks perfect English. He's got his arm around his mother and he's holding this poster he's so proud of that he says he'll hold in the march. He says, my mother has to stay here so that she is not arrested by ICE. I am my mother's voice. Yes, this administration is making heroes of many people, maybe unwittingly. But the people who are standing up for American values, universal values, are deeply inspiring.
We're spending the hour on the Vermont Conversation talking with Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, and she's here on a part of a national tour with 2 days in Vermont, tonight in Montpelier, tomorrow Bennington and Burlington in the evening. Amy, I remember
in
20 years.
Isn't it a Unitarian church that we're going to be in Burlington, right, on Pearl Street?
Yes, it is. And the Unitarian Church is one of the sponsors of that event. I remember 20 years ago when you came home to announce this new experiment you were taking part in, an election show that would run for 8 months in 1996. So 20 years later, this is a moment, you take this moment in the book, but also take a moment now. What are you proudest of? What lets you know that Democracy Now!, this little 8-month experiment that turned into a 20-year and hopefully many more run, has made a difference?
Well, first, our family. I mean, the great Jasper Goodman and Ariel and Sue Minter and our brothers in other parts of the United States and their families. And Democracy Now! Is also a voice for families all over this country and around the world. And how important it is that together with my colleagues at Democracy Now, building this platform for people to speak for themselves. I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day, war and peace, life and death. Anything less than that is a disservice to the servicemen and women of this country who can't have these debates on military bases. They rely on us and civilian society to have the discussions that lead to the decisions about whether they live or die, whether they're sent to kill or be killed. Anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society. You know, interestingly, it was another story of Denver. Oh, a year or two ago, we were going through Denver International Airport, and there was a group of soldiers who were there to pick up a general for a general's conference. And as the Democracy Now! Team walked by, they started to wave wildly. And I was looking behind me. Is the general behind me? And then we got our luggage, walked past, they're waving again. So I went up to them and I said, do you know Democracy Now? And they said, of course. I said, do you watch Democracy Now? Every day, ma'am, they said. I said, is it just you? I said to this one guy, he said, oh, no, ma'am, all of us on the base. And I said, why? And they said, because you cover war. You cover what we do. It's not about being for war or against war. It's about showing the reality on the ground. That's the reality TV that we do. That's the reality radio that we are engaged in, showing the reality of people's lives. And I think that is what I am most proud of. Again, it's going to where the silence is. Whether we went to East Timor to cover the movement for independence in East Timor from a murderous regime that had killed a third of the population in Timor, that certainly had profound effects, not only on me, on the world, surviving this massacre in 1991 when we saw over 250 Timorese gunned down by Indonesian soldiers using US M16s. Ultimately, 8 years later, the people of East Timor in a UN-sponsored referendum would be able to vote for their independence and become one of the newest nations in the world. And I was there to witness that in 2002. Or Haiti covering the, you know, people being gunned down, going to the polls, those who run for office killed in the street, and yet people still voted. They have a higher percentage of people voting than we do in the United States. I mean, when we started Democracy Now!, I was in an underground house in Haiti and called to ask to host Democracy Now!. And I'm thinking, people are risking their lives and most vote in Haiti where that wasn't the case in the United States. And I understood the importance of elections. If all people are engaged, then they will have people that represent them and are involved in all different ways themselves. And giving voice to these grassroots movements for civic participation, for justice, racial, economic justice, talking about the fate of the planet. I mean, Vermont, how important it is around the issue of renewable energy in states all over this country, how critical taking on climate change is. So covering the climate summits and the thousands of people who come from the most endangered places, from the Maldives, 15-year-old boy who looked into our camera in the Copenhagen UN summit and said, you are drowning our country. The people of sub-Saharan Africa who come to the UN climate summits who say, you are cooking our continent. And bringing these voices back home to the most powerful country on earth, our country, the United States. The climate change movement is much more advanced in other parts of the world. They don't debate whether climate change is human-induced. They know the facts. It's science. They're debating what to do about it. Here in this country, it's as if every time you want to talk about climate change, you have to bring on for balance, you know, a member of the Flat Earth Society. No, I mean, if you're debating, whether the planet is round, you have to bring on a member of the Flat Earth Society. It's ludicrous. We just did a five-hour broadcast last Saturday from the March for Science in Washington. You should have seen these young people talking about the ice melting and saying it's an irrefutable fact how important it is that we accept what's happening in the world and then make decisions about what we want to do about it. I mean, the signs this weekend at the UN, at the March for Science, and there were these marches all over the country, hundreds of thousands of people on every continent actually engaged in a march for science. What were some of the signs? There's no planet B. Ice has no agenda. It just melts. Champion evidence-based policies. And a woman holding up a sign that said, I'm with her, with an arrow to Mother Earth.
Over the course of the 20 years of Democracy Now!, you have broken and covered some remarkable and very memorable and moving stories, from standing vigil outside the jail where executions have happened, and you've done that on a number of occasions.
Right. I mean, the broadcast we did from the Jackson death row where Troy Anthony Davis was executed September 21st, 2011, the year that the bottom shook the top, the year of Occupy, the year of the protests against the Keystone XL, the year of the Wisconsin uprising of 150,000 people, the year of the Egyptian revolution and Tunisia taking down its dictator, 2011 at Jackson, Georgia. Being there to figure out during this broadcast what would happen to Troy Anthony Davis. There had been three death warrants issued against him, all stayed. He was 18 years old when he was picked up. He was accused of killing a police officer. It was a scene where in Savannah, Georgia, a man was pistol whipping a homeless man. This police officer who was moonlighting at doing security at a Greyhound station came out to save the homeless man, and he was shot before he even pulled his gun. His name was Mark McPhail. He was a hero cop, but the question was who killed him. And the man who most people fingered went to the police station with his lawyer and fingered Troy Davis. Troy Davis, who was 18 years old, said he didn't have a gun. He was immediately arrested, held for 2 years, and then convicted of murder, held on death row for 20 years, half of his life. And this was the day, September 21st, 2011, that would seal his fate. We didn't know what would happen, but we went to do the broadcast. There were 1,000 people on the grounds of the prison and just outside, heads of human rights organizations, Amnesty and NAACP, the family of Troy Anthony Davis. And we broadcast from the site. If we could have been in the execution chamber, we would have been. I mean, that may sound gruesome, but I really do believe in showing the images. People in the United States, I think most don't realize we are alone in the industrialized world when it comes to imposing the death penalty, carrying out the death penalty. And I think people are compassionate if they know. Well, we couldn't broadcast from the execution chamber, but right outside, who knew what would happen? We started at 6. We're interviewing people in the protest pen, the people who had come and held candles, you know, march from Atlanta, the historically black colleges of Spelman and Morehouse. People come from around the world. And then as the evening wore on, it was given to the Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who hails from Pinpoint, Georgia, right near Savannah, a community of freed slaves, founded by a community of freed slaves. And it didn't look good for Troy. And then at roughly 10:53 in the night, we heard the execution of Troy Anthony Davis had started. He was declared dead at 11:08 p.m. The reporters came out who had witnessed the execution and said Troy said his last words as he was strapped to that cross-like gurney with his arms strapped down, his legs strapped down, and the injection in his arm. He said, I want to turn to the McPhail family and say, I didn't kill your brother, your father, your husband. I did not have a gun. I wish you would continue to pursue the truth about what happened. He turned to his supporters who were there, his lawyer, and said, I hope my friends and family will continue to fight this fight. And then he turned to his executioners And he said, to those about to take my life, God have mercy on your souls and God bless your souls. And with that, he was executed. Troy's body was taken to Atlanta for autopsy. His family was charged for the transportation. We had been broadcasting for hours. And at the end of the night, the Department of Corrections threatened to pull the plug on our broadcast because the show was over. And I could only think as I looked out on this death row prison and what happened to Troy Anthony Davis about the words of Mahatma Gandhi when he was asked, what do you think of Western civilization? He said, I think it would be a good idea.
Amy, the question you often ask of people you interview, let me turn back on you, which is what gives you hope?
People who don't give up hope. That's what gives me hope. I've always been amazed, you know, in the face of enormous adversity in Haiti at the height of the coup there, people always believing that they could achieve a democratic government, deeply interested in politics. In East Timor, a young person would take me behind the house, dig in his backyard, and show me an article from a U.S. paper that he'd buried under the Indonesian occupation. And little article would say that the U.S. Congress had passed a resolution about East Timor. And I was thinking, this is a non-binding resolution. How could he think that this is the treasure and the hope of the future? And in the end, he was right. The people of East Timor won their freedom. And the little girl on the Standing Rock Reservation who is holding out a glass of water, or the elder who in a protest hands it to one of the riot police who have their weapons targeted on them and handing them a glass of water and saying, we are doing this not only for us and our children, but to protect the water for you and your children. It is this that gives me enormous hope.
Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! And My Sister, thanks for joining us on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you, David.
And that does it for this week's show. You can hear this and all shows at VermontConversation.com or on our podcast. And you can hear Amy and me speaking tonight at Montpelier at 7 o'clock at the Vermont College of Fine Arts, Thursday at Bennington and College at noon, and at the Unitarian Church of Burlington at 7 p.m. Thanks for listening.